So, our speaker today is Jeff Ritchie, who's a professor in the School of Oceanography here. He's also an adjunct professor in Owl College and College of Forest Resources and in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, and he's a member of the Quaternary Research Center. And he has a BA in biology from Stanford, a PhD from University of California, Davis. And he came to the UW here as a postdoc in the International Biological Program that I was involved with in about
3-4 years ago.
Early 70s, anyway. So I've known Jeff since the early 70s, which is 38 years or so. So his professional interests include drainage basins and riverine biogeochemistry, hydrologic cycles, sediment transport and gas fluxes, and modeling and remote sensing. And he's particularly interested in large drainage basins and land-ocean interactions in the coastal zone. And he is a leader of the UW Puget Sound Regional Synthesis Model, which is known as PRISM. And he's going to talk to us today about the virtual Puget Sound.
Thank you, Bob. Now, when I first came here, I had hair, and Bob's hair was black. Anyway, good morning. So as Bob said, I'm Jeff Ritchie from the School of Oceanography. You wonder why I'm in forestry. I regard myself as a terrestrial oceanographer, which is sort of an interesting concept by which you bring the sort of large-scale perspectives that oceanography does and apply it across the much more diverse and heterogeneous landscape of land. So today, I want to give kind of an overview of some of the approaches of looking at the overall issues of Puget Sound. Here's the state of the sound, because right now is a very interesting time for Puget Sound. A fair amount more attention is being paid to the condition of Puget Sound, discussing calling Puget Sound, oh my God, it's maybe dying, so we have to save it by 2020, and this sort of thing. Here's a state of the sound report snippet from 2007, put together as results from a series of existing state agencies through the so-called Puget Sound Ambient Monitoring Program, State Department of Ecology, and so forth. Details here aren't important, but the concepts of worrying about water quality, the issues of toxic contamination, stormwater runoff, pollution from human and animal waste. Then on the climate side is indicating that temperature may be rising, sea level rising, stream flow, snowpack changes, habitat changes. Now, one of the things that's a little frustrating about this diagram, though, is what do you pick up on that? It's qualitative. I mean, these are just sort of trends. This may be increasing by this much. It may be decreasing by that much. At the point of wanting to do not only solid science, but policy, it would be a good idea to be able to be much more specific about why each one of these different trends is going in the way it is. If we were to undertake certain actions, how would you be able to improve, quote-unquote, the condition of that and overall save Puget Sound, as the terms are going these days? So in addition to the sort of classic state agencies, now there is a new kid in town called the Puget Sound Partnership, which is founded just several months ago, basically, as a new state agency, but with sort of an overall view of trying to look at all the different aspects of Puget Sound. It's based on, it's made up of several parts. There's a leadership council, ecosystem coordination board, a science panel, all working together one level to produce a so-called action agenda as to what the overall sequence of events might be that the sound would, what could be undertaken. So the action agenda is looking at trying to define what is a healthy Puget Sound. And the legislation that created the partnership establishes a list of goals that sort of works towards how would you define the sound. What is the current status of Puget Sound's health, and what are the biggest threats to it? What actions must be taken that will move us from where we are today to a healthy sound by 2020, and where should we start? So a quite considerable political set of machinations has gone into try and make the decision. So if you have a big, long list of agenda items, how do you make a trade-off? Do you put a lot of money into improving the condition in the Duwamish? Do you try and push for so-called low-impact development in the Skagit? I mean, what's the overall sequence of events you do? And, of course, something like that gets quite complicated. If something happens over here, you want to know really, if you're trying to look at the overall sound, what's going to happen over here. But those causative links tend to be sort of difficult to pull together. And back to this, my initial point about qualitative trends versus a more definitive, how much is okay? If you go to this level, it's okay for X million dollars, but if you put in another Z million dollars, you don't get much gain. I mean, those are all the kinds of things you want to know. So the general approach that some of us have been looking at is a sort of a different way of looking at how to assess the overall condition of the sound and where do you go, by creating what we're calling a virtual Puget Sound. And the topic today here is to think about this as a process that we could evaluate alternate futures for what Puget Sound might eventually look like under different conditions of climate change, under different conditions of decisions that are made here and there. And in the process of doing it, it actually turns out to be really exciting science. Because if you have to respond to the questions that are being asked in Puget Sound, you actually have to put yourself as the basic scientist to address new boundary condition and situations. How does something that changes clear in somebody else's discipline in a whole different department affect me or the processes I'm looking at? So it's kind of this interesting process of really trying to push on the maximum of what's possible in sort of ecosystem science at this point. So today I want to give you a very quick overview of this thing called PRISM, as in this context is the engine that basically supports the development of this virtual Puget Sound. And what is involved in creating a virtual scalable basin as the basis for this virtual Puget Sound? It turns out there are all kinds of issues involved in actually trying to pull together a really integrative synthesis sort of environment. And so it's actually worth touching a bit on what goes into that. And then I'll give several example applications for Puget Sound. And I'll emphasize in these the terrestrial. The case studies I'll go through are more on the terrestrial side of things, though PRISM has a very major marine component. And those that want to learn more about that, please feel free to see me and talk about that side of things. And then a brief, what are sort of the next steps and opportunities that are possible through this whole VPS construct. Okay, so first of all, there's a project at the UW called PRISM. PRISM stands for the Puget Sound Regional Synthesis Model. It's a so-called University Initiative Fund, UIF project, equivalent to the Program on Climate Change, PCC, other programs elsewhere on campus, by which the previous president taxed existing budgets a certain amount to create a new pool of money, which didn't make him very popular, and he's no longer here. And he's not the person, though, that hired the football coach. So it's a different situation. But basically, so the idea of PRISM is that it's an enterprise across all of the University of Washington involving forestry, oceanography, fisheries, civil engineering, and so forth, to develop this highly integrated way of looking at the sound. We also look at it as a major regional resource. It is money from Olympia, after all, and so how do you work out the partnerships with all the different local, state, and federal agencies while bringing something new to the table? Makes for an interesting combination of things. Basically PRISM looks at sort of three simultaneous issues. One is education. I mean, how can we use the overall process of education, graduate and undergraduate education, to develop this overall virtual Puget Sound? Two gentlemen over here, Richard and John, are teaching a course this even as we speak to beginning undergraduates on what are the overall sets of issues involved in Puget Sound. Then there's the basic research science part of things, and the idea is to be not just another pocket of money for somebody to go do their project, but to really focus on the more integrative kinds of things. And ultimately, that gets into sort of two aspects. One is the natural science. Here's the water cycle. Here's a salmon swimming around sort of thing. But also, as you'll see, we'll get to in a minute, the fair amount on the whole sort of cyber infrastructure, computer side of how you actually do this. Not because we're inherent geeks or anything, though several of us are, not me. But it turns out how you actually go about all this information since the synthesis is a fairly tricky business, and so we've had to pay a lot of attention to the visualizations and the all the details under the hood. And then a major aspect is on the working with regional enterprises, the various agencies and so forth. So as kind of the quick overview, so here's Puget Sound, three-dimensional topography, and the how you make the mix between the basically the natural structure or the physical, biophysical structure, let's call it natural, the land convergence, the distribution of the different wetlands, forests, grass, and impervious surfaces, water resources, gas emissions, and so forth. And overlay on that is how do you look at the impacts of households and developers and businesses and all this sort of stuff. How do you make those several worlds merge? So then through the activities, you're not going to be quizzed on each one of these boxes, I assure you. But the point is that to get to these sort of overarching goals of looking at the overall dynamics of the system, we've launched a whole series of individual activities, urban growth, the construction of the physical templates, atmospheric circulation, so forth, work your way around. And each one of those has been an effort by somebody, sort of either core staff, and in a lot of cases students, have been involved to develop sort of those pieces. And then we look at how do you pull the overall enterprise together so that these aren't just a bunch of postage stamps, which is, of course, exactly what this looks like, but what's the sort of the greater enterprise you can bring from it. So the sort of the first step is, say, what we're calling this virtual scalable basin. So virtual obviously means that it's not real, but relies on, in that sense, but computer technologies and modern visualization capabilities and so forth. Scalable is actually an important part of this. So a lot of you, let me phrase that. How many of you have a research project looking at a small stream or a small plot of land someplace? Probably a lot of you. Okay, how do you go from that little plot up to a bigger area and ultimately up to the whole area of the sound? At the same time, how do you go from climate that spreads over whole regions down to your plot? There are all kinds of interesting trade-offs that happen along the way of trying to do that. So both as a metaphor and as practical engine for organizing information, we're basically trying to create this sort of information laboratory capable of flying without walls, flying in time and space, reaching the citizens of Puget Sound. So that's the basic idea of trying to pull all the different disparate information together. A subplot is that in the process of learning how to do this, it's actually not just restricted to Puget Sound. We're trying to think through, here's an Earth system module, take advantage of the resources and all the capabilities of this region to figure out how to actually go about doing this sort of thing, and then port it to other parts of the world. I mean, as you'll see, the key aspect here is just tracking the path of water. Water runs downhill in the Snohomish Basin or in the Amazon according to the same laws. So if we can figure these things out here and do everything that takes, then you have something very powerful that can go elsewhere in the world serving the same sort of basic function. But establishing this is not a trivial task. There's so many different forms of information and so forth that need to be dealt with. You get information from multiple different sources, different disciplines, even communication between groups. I'm an oceanographer up here in forestry now. Even that's a little unusual. And then not just modeling, but the computer part. But what are the new kinds of field measurements that are needed. We rely on so-called dynamic simulation models a lot that can recognize non-stationarity. This means that an awful lot of the thinking about Earth systems, water resources and all that, is always assumed that basically everything is stationary. You get the interannual variation and all that. But now with all the climate change issues and human impacts, you know, the classical time statistical records approach isn't really going to get the job done. And so these more process-based models is one way of getting there. But a lot of these models turn out in real life to come with a lot of legacy issues. Generations of graduate students have been working. Their thesis is, okay, we're going to develop the science behind this module and write it according to their understanding of the scripting language of that model. Somebody does something else different here. Pretty soon you have this long, unwieldy thing that represents really, really clever thinking. But the execution for the next graduate student to come along becomes pretty tricky. So how do we clean up all that sort of stuff? Just handling all the different data streams, different data formats, and all that. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I have problems going from Windows 2003 to Windows 2007, or vice versa, I guess, is the problem. But think about that in terms of the multiple model outputs and all these little horrible realities of things. And then we want to be able to not only create all that information from the specialists, but get it to local and regional decision makers, to local farmers, or even to Tim Eyman. So to actually go about doing this, we've worked at establishing a so-called cyber infrastructure, where on this side you have atmosphere, near shore, marine environments, so forth, and then the various mechanics involved in processing the information. So basically you want to be able to develop base data layers, directed data layers, so from that information you create the information needed for the models and so forth, the simulation models, the ability to handle visualizations, and decision support for scenario testing capabilities. And then this has gone through a lot of evolution over time. But one of the things that we hadn't really expected early on, but it's how powerful the whole visualization aspect of this is. The ability to create colorful images for the decision maker type is actually a pretty big deal in all this. Most of us technical people can barely understand some of our own graphs, never mind trying to convince somebody about those. And so giving a lot of thought to how do you go from data transformations, content catalogs, and all these various bits. And the sort of latest generation, some of you I'm sure know, have been working with Google Earth, but taking some of those kinds of concepts and being able to adapt that technology for being able to take in the basically more complicated data streams and model outputs and so forth. Okay, so even though it may not be fascinating to you, I felt it was important to at least sort of go through that structure. Now we'll start bringing it a bit more into life. So basically, the whole process is pretty simple. What's the integrated climate, land, surface, water cycle, using the hydrologic cycle as a defining framework, where you have all the different rainfall, different topographies, vegetation intercepting, and all that. Turns out when you want to make one of these virtual basins is that the information that, say, somebody that's interested in forest conversion aspects can really use, really producing highly specialized information that's useful to somebody else in the food chain, say to the hydrologist who's only interested in a gauge downstream. So the more you can build on each one of these information layers, the more useful a construct you have. So we think about, first of all, developing digital elevation models, which involves the topography, mass, river networks, and so forth. Interesting thing here, back to this whole space-time thing, is that's something that's set essentially over geological time scales. Then we need models of soils, which basically are set on more decade-century sorts of scales. Then the models of vegetation, and not just what kind of veg is where, but what are the biophysical attributes that lead to how much evapotranspiration there is, rooting depths, the whole biophysics essentially involved in the vegetation. And finally, the model of surface climate, precip temperature, and so forth. Now, it turns out these are the layers required to run one of these sort of called landscape hydrology models. That so for each pixel on the landscape, you build on all these different attribute layers and produce what the dynamics of that basin actually might be. Now, there are various ones of these sorts of things, but in the more modern sense, there aren't all that many. One of the ones that's been developed, so-called model, and this is called DHSVM, which is an acronym only a civil engineer could come up with. These are the people that did it, the distributed hydrology soil vegetation model, developed, say, in civil engineering, that looks at these accounts for these different attributes of the hydrologic cycle as a function of the landscape and topography and so forth, and tracks the movement of water through these processes. Now, to the basic hydrology model, we've been adding several variants that actually move materials. At the point where you actually can account for how water moves, you're a long way towards being able to account for how carbon and nitrogen, sediment transport, and so forth happens. And these are variants of the model that account for those. For example, we're trying to develop now this DHSVM solute export model, DSEM, that basically will look at the same attributes of the landscape that sets the water movement, but then you can put in, here's the nitrogen cycle, here's the carbon cycle. We're pretty excited about the progress in this. You'll see an application of it here in a minute. All right, so in terms of how things would come out, so in this case, a snow event over the landscape. And then in the case of the Snohomish Basin, the various attributes become, so here's the template, that which you built the model on. Here's the climate forcing, wind fields, air temperature, rainfall patterns, producing these output fields of soil temperature, soil moisture, and the flow through the river channels. Now, because these are being set up as much as possible anyway in the so-called process base, we're saying that the problem of converting rainfall to runoff is an ages-old one in forestry and hydrology, and the links between those. But traditionally, there's been a fair amount of statistics and so forth involved. In the problem, back to that non-stationarity argument, is that as the world changes, those kind of records become more problematic to interpret, and these kinds of, by expressing the processes involved. Evapotranspiration happens because, sort of thing, then ability to look at change becomes greater. So now give several examples. In this case, looking at stream flow change due to land cover and to climate change. This is a fairly major project. LANDCO was a postdoc in civil engineering shared between PRISM and the Climate Impacts Group. I'll just give a real quick summary of some of the work that was done. There's much more in back of this and several papers and talks and so forth that do it. So here is a map of Puget Sound circa 1860. Now, I bet not many of you knew that NASA had satellites back then, but to produce these, but some of the early balloons from the Civil War were brought in with some of the early imagers to create these maps. Well, not really, but that said, so one of the things that becomes really interesting in trying to go back and see what historic conditions used to be is how do you actually go back and reconstruct them? So there are several groups around campus that do that. The River History Project, some of you may have heard of, with Dave Montgomery and company, that have gone back and looking at, as with PRISM support, at looking at a lot of is what the region used to look like. Then here is a version of Puget Sound in 2002. So how would you expect water flow regimes to change as you move from the late 1800s natural conditions to current conditions? And then, of course, the scenario part comes in. If by 2020 or 2040, lots of things are going to happen. Population's going to increase, climate's liable to change. So how would you expect those flow regimes to play out? And by looking at these sort of things, you can say, okay, well, maybe this development probably shouldn't happen there, but it should be over here. Or at a more reactionary level, given that that's going to happen, how do you plan whatever infrastructure and so forth you're doing, or how do you at best adapt to, even if you can't mitigate, what the outcomes are going to be? So the immediate questions then is, how do current land cover change and climate affect stream flow compared to early settlement? And then what will happen into the future? The methodologies that are used is basically then you have to come up with the climate in 1915 or 1925 and so forth and develop the climate record. So a tremendous amount of work goes into reconstructing the climate. For scenarios of the future, you get into the different climate models of what's going to happen, or what might happen, not what's going to happen, what might happen under certain assumptions. Turns out one of the things that's interesting, and I certainly hadn't appreciated in the beginning of all this, is that in setting up these, working with these dynamic models, 95% of the work is developing the data layers and the assumptions and where does the information come from and the cross-checking and all that. Running the models is actually relatively, I shouldn't say relatively simple, but is only a part of the overall process. And so in this case, then Lan used different land cover, had different land covers, different change scenarios, used the DHSVM model across all of Puget Sound, and used the calibrated model then for stream flow for the different scenarios. So these are just the results of some of the calibration. A lot of details in here, and I know there are those of you in the crowd who are thinking, gee, he's being real simplistic in this discussion, but the way, so basically you run a model, develop the climate over the area, and then go to those spots where you actually have real-life information and try and both calibrate and validate the models against known data records. And you can see the red lines, the simulation, and the blue lines match up pretty well for these several different conditions. Now, of course, it's what becomes interesting in all this is what happens when they don't. Now, anybody can sit here and tweak knobs enough to make the lines match up. I mean, that's really not the point of this exercise. When they don't, though, you ask why. Now, Steve Burgess in Civil Engineering said a few years ago that to adequately describe the rainfall over Bellevue, okay, just about, you know, pretty small area, you need order 600 gauges, rain gauges. It probably not going to happen. And here we've got calibration over just 4 points over all of Puget Sound. The gauges in the Snohomish are considerably lower and very little in the upper. And so one of the things I find intriguing about all this sort of approach is the interpolation aspects, the assumptions that go into producing whichever data fields you're working with. So you really have to be thinking about it along the way. But at a minimum, if you're pretty confident that you have, say, that point and that point correct, then you have at least a little bit of confidence that you're probably not terribly far out at the areas in between. And an interesting example of this sort of approach, I also work in the Mekong River in Southeast Asia, where data records are pretty good on some of the sites, but for a number of the tributaries and main stem stations with all the wars and so forth are sort of non-existent. But then you can go back and sort of recompute what the flows might have been during those periods of absolutely zero records and give some insight into what those areas may have been like. Okay, so just a couple of runs. So basically, here's a high elevation site, the Skagit. Here's Mercer, Skokomish, Hood Canal area, and the Cedar Rivers. showing the land cover. So this would be under the land, increased intact land, more intact land cover back then, and the higher flows now. Now, does that surprise you? Why do you think this would be? You're moving from a forested environment, trees with deep roots and all that, that would have higher evapotranspiration and the like. And so now you're going to an environment where there's less water can be intercepted by those processes and more can run off. You also have, what's the difference in runoff capabilities between a forest floor and a parking lot? Quite considerable, right? Water hits a parking lot and jets right across, doesn't go in and have the much longer lag periods. So this makes sense. Of course, what you really want to get to is how detailed and why are these different things happening. Okay, so then you can look at the slide that isn't coming up for whatever reason is interesting. It shows the Olympic side of Puget Sound and runs different climate scenarios over them. So here's it, sort of the best shot at what it would have been in the 1800s, what it looks like today, and what the future climates might bring. And so the conclusions from these several studies is first that under the land cover studies in upland basins, well, you can read these faster than I can speak to it, but basically it looks at the effects of how land cover conversion would affect what the water flow patterns are. Then the next batch of things is the climate studies. So what effects would different temperature change regimes have, rainfall, greater winter precipitation falling as rain rather than snow, all this sort of stuff. And then the bottom, I thought, interesting, land cover change dominates the lowland where urbanization occurs. Temperature and land cover change both function in the upland basins. So if you're a water resource planner, some of you may end up working for Snohomish County or the city of Seattle or whatever, and these are the kinds of questions that you're going to be asked to design your resource structures around. All right, so this gives you a bit of a view of just sort of the water part over all of Puget Sound. Now we're going to zoom in, so back to our whole scalable basin construct ideas, and look at Hood Canal. Now, it turns out a very interesting thing is happening in Hood Canal in that over the last several years, reduced oxygen has been seen to the point where fish kills have occurred. So the question becomes, gee, why is that? And there's a lot of perception that Hood Canal is a pretty pristine part of our of Puget Sound, and it sort of turns out to be kind of ghastly to people. To find out that, gee, maybe it's not so pristine, that low oxygen conditions are killing off the fish and so forth. And if it turns out that Congressman Dix is one of the people on that canal who are horrified by this, then means are found to study the situation in considerably more detail. So a program called the Hood Canal Dissolved Oxygen Program, HCDOP, was started about 3 years ago as we'll see in a minute, but a very interesting example of how collaboration and cooperation in the region can go forward. Based on a core pot of money from Congressman Dix, but also various other pots of money and cooperations, a really wide group of people from the different state agencies, local citizen groups on Hood Canal, University of Washington, and so forth, got together to really try and crack this problem. Detailed measurements and modeling of the marine side of Hood Canal, looking at the exact timing of oxygen depletion relative to relative to circulation patterns driven by tides and wind, and so forth. So, our immediate part that I lead is the watershed inputs to Hood Canal. How much comes from where and why? Big question here is what effects are on-site septic tanks having? Because that's especially in the south end of the canal. Is this in fact a big deal? Or is it not a big deal? where, so basically come up with an overall nitrogen budget. So basically we had a scheme for direct measurements of water chemistry. You'll see it a lot of different places, geospatial models of the land surface properties, looking at assessing freshwater inputs, both from gauge records, which turn out to be sort of sparse, and then using the modeling environment to help interpolate, then coupling the hydrology geochemical modeling, then on the basis of the flux numbers, kind of try and partition it into where does it come from, the different nitrogen sources, and what would happen in the future. And these are not idle questions. There's a House bill sitting in Olympia right now waiting for the outcomes of this study that says that quite expensive. So basically, do you sewer Hood Canal? And if you, because of the on-site septic issue, if you do, you might also get to the sort of nonlinear effects of, gee, here comes some more, now that we don't have to worry about on-site septics, oh, we'll have a whole lot more development than we would have otherwise. So all these kind of really interesting playouts. And again, this is not just an idle exercise. We testified before in Olympia on this stuff. There's a House bill waiting and all that. So this, theoretical ivory towered professor and students come meets real life in these sort of studies, which is the challenge and part of the excitement of the whole thing. So basically, we set up a monthly sampling program, 43 different stations all up and down Hood Canal, sampled it monthly for 3 years. Again, it's a real collaborative venture. So students from here, including one of the early students in this project, was from the College of Forest Resources, and then students from civil engineering, and now oceanography keeping that up, taking out a sampling scheme, taking bottles down to Hood Canal, various citizens and so forth, collecting them, bringing them back. So a really nice example of collaborations. And then some, fairly minor yet, but storm event sampling. So those of you who are worried about monthly sampling when you're missing storms like last night, we're at least trying to think about how to put those in. So in this case, breaking the watershed up into this various attributes. Here's the total dissolved nitrogen for several of the rivers. The Union and Mission, more developed. Skokomish and Hamahama, less developed. Then, in this case, organizing by which are the Olympic watersheds, which are the lowland mixed watersheds, and so forth. Still looking for the smoking gun in this, which I haven't quite gotten to. So basically, what this pretty much shows is that the mature conifer and the least densely populated watersheds have the lowest concentrations, and most densely populated have higher. And they also have more mixed deciduous, which has alder, which does what? Fixes nitrogen, could be a player in all this, which hadn't really been appreciated at the beginning. So sort of dialing together the modeling and direct measurements, sequences. And so that's, this is the total load. This is what we'd call pristine or the coniferous areas. Here's the alders. So basically alders across the basin. Now, these are all first cut estimates. And we're working hard at refining this via various means. So it contributed a surprising amount. And the people part, which includes the on-site septics part, becomes a factor. All right, zooming in during the sort of critical summer months to the lower end of Hood Canal, the so-called Lynch Cove area. So the USGS, our partners in this operation too, have been making sort of highly detailed seepage measurements. So this would be the prediction of a flow over the course of the year. So during the winter months, of course, tremendous amounts of water, lots of stuff gets mobilized. But that's the least biologically active time. So what becomes important is what's happening in the summer oxygen minimum times. So we try and go in and look at that. Lots of work to do on rationalizing these different numbers. So basically we came up for the June 30th summit, so-called, for Lower Hood Canal, that this amount would be so-called pristine, this amount alders, this amount sort of the upland people septics amount, shoreline septics. So it turns out there are a lot of, southern end of Hood Canal has houses that go right up against the shore. And turns out at high tide, some of the septics there just get completely flushed out directly. Sort of a horrifying thought. But. And then estimates of shoreline groundwater input. Now, the only thing that's really interesting about this figure is that it tries to take estimates from a number of different sources and put them all on the same page. Considerable work and controversy internally going on and trying to refine these numbers, but that's what this is about. All right, so the conclusion on Hood Canal, does the Hood Canal watershed play a role in the marine environment? Is there an anthropogenic impact above pristine? Yep. Somehow or another, partition between alders and on-site septics and fertilizers and dogs and so forth. Are we sure of the numbers? Not at all. But it does seem that there is a definite impact. Does this nitrogen make a difference to the marine environment? It seems that there is actually a bit of a tipping point on the marine. There's an awful lot of nitrogen that comes in from the open ocean. And naturally, the nitrogen in the marine waters will go down. But around 2 milligrams per liter of oxygen is where you start getting fish kills and that sort of thing. It doesn't take all that much. So we're at that tipping point of the environment. So we're sort of looking like maybe the terrestrial input plays a 10 or 15% role in the oxygen budget of Hood Canal at the south end. At certain times of the year, and that may be just enough to tilt. So this is back to my earliest points of how important it is to be as quantitative and rigorous as possible in all this. And regardless of the marine impact, an awful lot of alterations in the freshwaters of Hood Canal, and that's important unto itself. So we zoom in at certain places, high detail, and move along. A new project is starting up, led by John Lombard over here, called the Skagit Alternatives Futures Project, which is basically looking at in the lower Skagit, especially how can you find any kind of rationalization between maintaining agricultural practices and all the other development pressures that are going on. And this is a project that involves not just the UW, but is led by Skagit County and so forth. And so another example of how we take this sort of mix and match of within this sort of virtual Puget Sound arena and zoom in to real-life, honest-to-God problems, issues. All right, so the next steps in all this is that we want to continue this nested hierarchy of models and ramp up to a wall-to-wall across all of Puget Sound and making a consistent frame of reference. Right now, there's lots of work that goes on in different places. You have no idea how work that's done in one place relates to something else. So we want to establish, first of all, a common template of contemporary and future land cover uses, compute water flow across it, build on that work by Lan and Company, but zoom in to specific places, develop partnerships with all the other models and efforts that are being done in the basin, then compute the overall material transport dissolved in particular, and pay including attention to some of the big issues around here, which includes the storm flow, stormwater runoff conditions, which mobilizes an awful lot of the toxic stuff. And while the models themselves are fairly good at this point, there's a long way to go, a lot of theses in the details of these things. And so basically, in conclusion, there's great potential for undergraduate and graduate student involvement in building on the legacy of the Water Center in moving this overall enterprise forward. Thank you.
So
feel free.
Could you put up the slide that was about the third or fourth from the beginning and had a prism wheel?
So one of the interesting things is how quickly, so it's sort of a mix and match. We really need people that really understand the geochemistry of nitrogen and soils. It also is now to the point where this basic virtual Puget Sound engine is being used in conjunction with guys in computer sciences to put forward a sort of frontiers in computer science stuff. We have a pre-proposal in now that if the pre-proposal were to be selected to go forward, and if heaven forfend we'd get that, it'd be $10 million. I mean, so the sort of the combined challenges on the cyber infrastructure side and the techie and the field science side is something I hadn't really anticipated in the beginning, but it's definitely an issue and all that. The question was, or the observation was, that I said in the beginning that in the sort of Earth system module, can we repeat this elsewhere in the world? And the answer is absolutely. One of the things, I actually came to this, coming up with the idea for PRISM from work in Southeast Asia in the first place. So now this whole idea of this virtual scalable basin, and I skipped some of the details on the dynamic information, though I sort of pointed those out, is definitely catching on elsewhere. For example, the World Bank has just established something called the Hydrology Expert Facility that's going to, with all the global water resource problems that are up, to try and the recognition that that with all the climate change and all that, you really have to think differently. And so this stuff is very much being used. So we've developed a prototype for the Zambezi in Mozambique. I just came back last week from the Mekong. And so now the virtual Mekong Basin is about to be signed in by the Mekong River Commission. China, I'm actually going to Bhutan in February to develop this exact same thing for there. But the lessons learned of how you actually do this, we can really beat through the horrors of it here. And then once that's in place, it's amazing how fast you can go somewhere else and do stuff. I've worked in Amazon as my main home for a long, long time. And we really beat our brains out trying to come up with some of these things there. And then I started in Southeast Asia, just as some of the NASA data were becoming more available and all that. And we got done in about a month what it took us 10 years to do in the Amazon. It's really interesting, actually, how that plays. So, yes, very much doesn't. Happy to talk with you more about that.
All right. So, time's up. So, thanks very much, Jim.